I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters,
and eventually, the end of the world. Are you serious? Everybody knows the Scientologists are scary, but how scary are they? Keith Henson, Scientology's public enemy number one, joins us today to talk about the powerful cult and also about space elevators, and perhaps we can use space elevators to escape the Scientologists. I don't know. We'll try to find out. This show is now being streamed on a weekly basis in general, and Jeff Diehl is going to tell you a little bit about that.
In general, yes. Not today, unfortunately, because the service that we use, Ustream.tv, was not allowing connections. Hopefully this will be remedied for next week and the weeks to come, but check here every Sunday at 2 p.m. Pacific, and by here I mean either of our websites for our podcasts, areyouseriousradio.com or mondoglobo.net/neophiles, and there's a link there to the show page, and you bookmark it and you come back when we're recording, which is Sundays 2 to 4 p.m. Pacific.
So in other words, Neophiles and the Are You Serious show are being streamed, and some of you may have even forgotten that Neophiles exists, and now you know that there are two fine shows for you to observe live.
And just to make it clear, the streaming sessions include a chat room, so you can actually ask questions, and we will forward them on live to the guests, so you can actually participate.
All right, so the shows are going to become more intelligent because you guys out there are going to help us out. And we are here today with Jeff Diehl, and Diana Brown is straight across from me. It's an unusual location for you.
It's an unusual juxtaposition. I am looking straight into the eye of the man that we all love and know as Are You Serious? Steve Robles is unable to be with us today. I understand he's on special assignment.
Exactly.
So I look forward to hearing all about that when he returns. And I know all of America would like to know just exactly what the Border Patrol has been doing. I mean, since 9/11, they have been, to quote a member of their own organization, they have been more diligent and vigilant than ever before. And you'll be happy to know that they are keeping out some high-profile criminals, such as this dear man, Andrew Felmar, a well-known Vancouver psychotherapist. He was coming into the great U.S. of A. to conduct a nefarious act of visiting his children when a border guard Googled him and told him he was no longer welcome in the U.S. of A. Are you drew my attention to this, and do you want to just jump in here, and then we'll fill them in on some
of the
broader details?
Well, apparently he has admitted that he took LSD in 1967.
Interesting that he would know about this.
In a psychology magazine or some kind of an intellectual journal.
Janus Head, I believe it was called, Janus Head,
so
yes.
This dangerous man had to be kept.
I mean, for your safety, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
And mine.
And now I suppose everybody who has ever admitted to taking illegal drug will be stopped at the border, and maybe just the Canadian border or anywhere.
Isn't it really the?
Will the Rolling Stones stop touring?
isn't the lesson here? For any reason whatsoever that the Border Patrol wants to not let you in, they will not let you in. I mean, he could have Googled it and saw that you like to, knit, Daffy Duck heads, and said, well, that's just too weird to come into our country.
Well, and actually, it might be considered I'm sorry, are you pleased?
No, I was going to say there is actually some law that Border Patrol person referred to.
The ideological exclusion provision
that's what they call it?
Yes. That's a law?
Well, it's I think it's more of a law than an edict handed down from on high, because it seems that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, under a particularly onerous section, the section of ideological exclusion, can keep you out. And,
this is a kind of a secret.
It kind of is
one
a secret.
It's not really a secret, but it's borders on, it's one of those things that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. That's really pretty extraordinary.
Well, in 2005, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a Freedom of Information Act request to learn more about just this use of the Patriot Act's ideological exclusion provision. And it's kept out some other nefarious evildoers,
yes,
such as the Cuban Grammy nominee, Ibram Farrar. If I'm saying your name wrong, I'm sorry.
Well, he's from Cuba.
That's right. So that's why he was kept out. But there's more.
Explanation done.
Done, said and done. Because, you know, God forbid we should get to smoke those cigars. So this dear man, Andrew Feldman, Feldmar, has pretty much decided that he's not ever getting back into the United States.
He has to pay money to in order to challenge this thing, right? $3,500 in order to...
To challenge this, and it would only be.
And they told him it would probably work.
But
if you challenge it, it'll probably work.
But only for a year, and then you have to challenge it every time he entered the country.
Yeah.
So with that, that's some kind of a clause written into the law that you can.
I guess so.
You pay $3,500 and you can get in the country. I wish it were that simple.
Some pure bureaucratic process and challenge.
$3,500?
Which I guess the Rolling Stones will be able to afford.
He contacted the U.S. consul in Vancouver to protest and was told to apply for a waiver. And then when he consulted a Seattle attorney, this gentleman named Bob Free at a firm, McDonald, Hogue, and Bayless, he learned that for $3,500 plus incidentals, he had a 90% chance to get the waiver. But it would probably be just for a year.
What are the incidentals? Wait. You have to buy a watch or something?
Who is he paying the money to? The
that
lawyer?
That is a bit unclear.
If he's paying it to the lawyer, that's just a legal fee.
Granted. And then he said it would have to be, the procedure would have to be initiated again and again anytime he had to cross the border. And what's more, he would have to produce a statement each time saying that he had been rehabilitated.
I mean, all this obviously needs to be discussed in terms of freedom of speech. Apparently, perhaps we
speech.
Have...
Speech. Freedom of thought.
Well, yeah. Freedom of speech, freedom of thought. Here, our right to hear people outside of our borders who may have at one time taken a drug.
I would really like to know how the law connects an ideological exclusion to somebody who's used an illegal drug in their lifetime. And how that relates to terrorism. That's what I would like to
know. Well, so many things to do with Homeland Security don't relate to terrorism.
Exactly.
They're
keeping him out on two things. First of all, they're saying that he admitted to drug use. According to Mike Mline, U.S. spokesman for the U.S. Border Patrol and Protection, based in Seattle, no less. And he said that it's in the U.S. law immigration handbook stating that you can be ineligible to receive. Boy, Dinah, I'm having trouble speaking today. Ineligible for admission if indeed you admitted to drug use. Well, he had written an article saying 40 years ago, he had experimented with LSD in the context of, psychoanalytic discovery. And he had shared this. And he now feels like he had totally blew it. He wishes he had heeded the ancient alchemist dictum, do, dare, and be silent. And he goes on to urge his fellows to be very careful about what they post on the web.
Well, that's the wrong lesson, I think.
I mean, too, but he's been beaten down, it seems.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this for a while, that there should be like an absurdity clause to all laws, and there should be some panel that you can appeal to on the basis of this is too ludicrous. should be able to get a hearing.
The surreality clause.
You know, yeah, yeah. Perhaps certain laws have a reason to exist, but in the specific, they are frequently ludicrous. Though I don't think this law should exist at all, but you could argue.
I think that's a great idea. Never heard of anybody bringing that standard into legal procedures.
It might
absurdity.
Be time. For,
yeah,
the absurdity clause.
Yeah.
What I love is that the way they learned about his past and decided to bar him from our great nation was by Googling him, which I think is doubly funny considering that this gentleman who works for the Homeland Security and the Border Patrol says, well, one of the things we have done is to update our information systems.
Yeah.
Oh, so now we have allowed our border guards to utilize Google, and that is the great upgrade they're speaking of.
Well, I hope they at least can prevent Sting from touring America again.
When the beam of light is broken by a solid object, such as this head, the electric eye control opens the faucet, and there's your drink.
On April 26, 2001, Keith Henson was convicted of interfering with a religion, a misdemeanor under California law, for picketing outside Scientology's heavily armed razor wire enforced base outside Hemet, California. He split for Canada, becoming the world's first Scientology fugitive, and he's now back in the U.S. dealing with a variety of court cases related to Scientology. But Scientology isn't Keith's only interest. Just before he was arrested, he was scheduled to talk at a European Space Agency conference on how space elevators could completely solve the carbon and energy problems. And Keith Henson has been a space buff since he was 8 years old. And back in 1975, he and others, including nanotech guru K. Eric Drexler, founded the L5 Society. I was paying attention to that at the time. They promoted space colonies and solar power satellites built out of metals extracted from moon rock. And that L5 Society eventually became the National Space Society. And we're going to talk about both these things, his problems with the Scientologists and the space elevator, on today's program. So welcome, Keith.
Hi there.
Hi. So, what's your favorite Tom Cruise movie?
None of them. My dislike for the cult has spilled over into everything that's associated with it. But I do have to admit, Tom has been very effective at taking Scientology down. He certainly did more damage to their image in a year than I did in 10. And he and Katie aren't done yet, I betcha.
All right. He played a creepy head fucker quite effectively on Magnolia. Worth seeing if you can tolerate going to see Mr. Cruise. It's been said that you fear the Scientologists will get to you if you're in the Riverside Jail. Some people who are otherwise sympathetic have expressed skepticism about this. And do you have any evidence, any reason to fear the thuggery of Scientologists in the tank?
I sure do. I have evidence that I accidentally acquired a few weeks ago that the Riverside courts themselves were engaged in outright criminal acts, that is, using the power of the courts to entrap me into a crime.
Okay, well, that's a pretty heavy charge. Can you substantiate it?
Sure. If you Google for Secor and Henson, the first link will take you to a letter I wrote about it in 2001. I just never imagined I would get paper evidence pulled out of the county's court files. Well, recently, I was handed a paper out of the Riverside court files that had never been listed as part of the files. Obviously, somebody went looking for a warrant to send over to Arizona and pulled it out without looking at the date. I know now, of course, that Riverside Court illegally keeps secret documents that are not listed in the docket. What was on this, what I accidentally found out, was the very warrant that would have been used to arrest me at that deposition. It's dated September 15, 2000, and sure enough, they listed the charge of failure to appear on it. And that's just not a crime that happened on September the 15th, so the arrest warrant could not possibly have been filled out that day. It was most likely filled out weeks before the date on it. In issuing a warrant for a crime that never happened, the court itself was complicit in a serious criminal act, one that if a person were convicted of, they could spend many years in prison.
Well, obviously they're very well connected, but you've received a lot of public support. Does that make you safer?
Yes, it does. I was treated fairly roughly until hundreds of phone calls came into the jail, and then they realized that this was not a person they could just shove down a hole and forget.
So have any establishment figures come to your side?
Mostly no. It's amazing how some people who are considered really brave heroes get terrified by the Scientology cult. I hesitate to say which one of them panicked when I asked him to make a phone call for me to keep me in Canada. But if you think about it, you could probably figure it out.
Well, I'm sure it's not Jerry Brown, who used to be an L5er, is now the Attorney General of California. Did you ever have any interactions with him?
Not yet. I've actually got a email from them that says I should file essentially a complaint against the district attorney in the courts.
Uh-huh. Did you have any interactions with him back when you were in the L5?
I'd never met Jerry back in those days. I met a number of the other people, George Brown, for example. And a fair number of the other ones. And, of course, Rusty Schweikert was a good buddies of Jerry Brown.
Right, so you met other people in the administration. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about your upcoming case?
Which one? I got three of them open at the morning, at the moment. There's a motion to correct an injunction that the Riverside Court was not permitted to issue. A bankruptcy case that has got tangled up recently with O.J. Simpson's, and this extradition business in Arizona. That last one requires the California governor to sign an extradition warrant, and there's been enough complaints to him about it that I don't think he's going to do it.
It's weird to hear O.J. Simpson's name come up. I don't suppose you can talk any more about your connection with O.J. There could be a book contract in there for you. The book industry loves O.J.
I can give you a quick thing. It turns out that my bank, that the lawyer for the other side in the bankruptcy case, had a bunch of work to do for O.J. Simpson, so he asked for work against O.J. Simpson for the Goldbergs, I think it was. So he asked for a delay.
All right. Well, let's move on. We will contemplate your possible connections with the O.J. case over the coming weeks and months, and maybe. Get back to it. I don't know if the e-meter doesn't fit, you must acquit maybe or something. I don't know. You've been working on ideas for power satellites recently, and what is that, and how old is the idea, and how did you wind up back in the space engineering area again?
Well, it's actually connected to the Scientology cult. It's impossible to be employed when you're trying to hide out from them. They have agents inside the IRS, so when you send in your social security number, they just pull it and come and get you. So I spent a lot of the time in the last year working on a post-singularity novel. And I didn't want to work on it, write about wars and violence, which is in the cards if we don't solve the energy crisis. So I had to have the people in the novel have some way to do that. There are only a few ways to get the amount of power needed to replace the fossil fuel sources that we've been using up. Power satellites are one of them. Power satellites are just a way to put solar power collectors where the sun shines more of the time and no clouds are in the way. They're just giant collectors of solar collectors in orbit, microwave transmitters, and gigantic receivers on Earth. They're an old idea. It's been 38 years since Peter Glaser invented them. I revived the idea to cope with the energy and global warming for this novel. It's one of the few ways you can deal with both.
So, I mean, just to be really clear, how does it resolve energy and global warming problems?
Well, there are a few approaches that are big enough to deal with the energy problems that we get from oil and coal. Power satellites are one of them. And if you have the capacity to build power sats, you can build planetary scale sunshades as well.
Terrestrial energy alternatives to this? I mean,
the only ones I know about are fusion and fission plants. A lot of fission power or huge fusion plants. They both suffer from a really nasty problem. It's just too easy to divert neutrons toward making high quality plutonium, like 99% plutonium-239, and with that, it becomes very easy to make terrorist nukes. You can Google Henson plutonium depleted, because you use depleted uranium to make this, if you want to see what I wrote about it.
Okay, so apparently these things could be a threat of some sort. We keep on hearing everything seems to be a threat. Let's get back to the power satellites. So tell us more about those.
Okay, there are three parts to the power sat. Making the energy out of sunlight and space, which you can use enormous structures, lightweight structures in geosynchronous orbit. And, you know, you can either use solar cells on the thing or, you know, steam turbines for all I care. And then you have a big transmitter to turn the power into a microwave beam of huge size. And then you need a gigantic antenna on the ground that converts the microwaves back to electricity.
How big would it be?
Well, if you could fit one in an area of about 40 square miles, that's the size of a medium city. The ground antenna would be about 50 square miles. That sounds like a lot of land, but the receiving antenna is light mesh. It doesn't block the sunlight, so you can put it over farmland and still farm underneath it. You may wonder why is this better than using terrestrial solar power if you're going to use that? That does take a lot of land, a lot more.
Might this not kill off all the bees or something?
What's it now?
Might living under this antenna? Might it not do something else strange to people?
Well,
I mean, for instance,
yeah.
People are talking about cell phones killing off all the bees.
Well, actually, it turns out that's ridiculous, and cell phones were around a long time before the bees disappeared.
That's too bad, because I'm putting like about a dozen cell phones on my front porch.
But I'll tell you this, the power level that you get in a power satellite out in the middle of the thing isn't any more power than you get to your head.
Oh, really?
When you've got a cell phone running. It's pretty low.
So you could actually fly through this beam?
Well, yeah, I propose really that we use much higher powered beams, and then we just have a restaurant on wheels where you put the thing in a duck flyway, and you just move the restaurant around to the north side in the spring and to the south side in the fall, and the ducks just fall out of the air completely cooked.
Wow, that sounds pretty tasty. So you've been talking about this for a long time. Why haven't we moved in this direction? A number of people have been talking about this.
Well, the one holdup that's got it is the transport cost to orbit. Rockets are just terrible efficient-wise. I mean, you see this enormous blast of well, you remember probably seeing the launches of the Apollos and everything else. It's just terrible, wasteful. But using nanotubes, we can maybe build a space elevator.
But getting this stuff up there... getting this stuff up there is just a one-time expense, though, right?
Yeah, well, it sort of is and sort of isn't. You have to power these things because there's no free lunch. But you can probably haul up something like a few, maybe 100 tons, maybe a couple of 100 tons. You have to push it clear out to geosync, and then you have to unreel it both directions. Anyway, once you've built one of these things, it only costs you to run it. Now, there's a long time people have been, I think, hung up on a pathway that was just plain wrong. They've been trying to design, figure out how to use climbers that are using beamed power, mostly lasers, to beam it up there. Electric driving wheels on the things powered by lasers. They're better than rockets, which are around maybe 1% efficient, but the best you can estimates I've got from the people that are working on it are around 7%. Which is still just terrible. In working on this novel, which going back to the Scientologist forcing me to do that, I came up with a moving cable design because if you're going to try to solve the energy problem, the traffic you need into space is enormous. It's a couple of thousand tons a day.
Hmm.
So anyway, that's the idea of the thing is an elevator that runs on a bunch of pulleys up into space, and you just power the thing from the bottom.
I want to ask how fast this thing moves, but first let's stop and hear a little music, and we'll be right back with Keith Henson. Welcome back. We're talking to Keith Henson about Scientologists and space elevators and Never the Twain Shall Meet. The space elevator, how fast this baby going to take me up into space?
I'm not sure. The faster you go, the more throughput you get. I think you can run it maybe as high as 1,000 miles an hour. At that speed, it's 22,000 miles out there, so at that speed it'd take you 22 hours to get to Geo. You got to bring your lunch and dinner and I guess even breakfast.
Now, the initial idea is to bring equipment up there. I mean, how could this cause some difficulties for human beings? Or I guess 1,000 miles an hour, it's not unthinkable, is it?
No, the only reason you wouldn't run, in fact, I think you'd actually want to run faster than that. But remember, I'm driving this thing as an endless loop from the ground. And so that means the lowest part of the thing is in the atmosphere. And, you know, running up through the atmosphere at 1,000 miles an hour is all sorts of, you know, supersonic shock waves and everything else like that.
Right. Now, you have to use a nanotube cable to do this, right? And do I understand that this technology is basically plausible at this point?
They've actually measured the strength of nanotube cable, and it's strong enough to do the job. If you can get it up to 63 gigapascals, you can just run it over a pulley at GeoSync. But if you can't do that, you can run it. There's a way that you can run intermediate stepped pulleys in the thing where you can get a constant diameter cable, but a stepped number of strands in parallel on it. It has to be nanotube or something that's that strong and light. Steel isn't anywhere near good enough. In fact, the problem of it is with steel is you start off with a 1 centimeter diameter cable at the Earth, and it's hundreds of kilometers thick at geosynchronous. So you get to the nanotube sort of stuff, and they've measured it at almost 6 million pounds per square inch. And it's only 30% denser than water, so that's strong enough and light enough, but it's a bit expensive.
All right, well, how expensive is it?
Yeah, carbon nanotubes, if you buy them, are $75 million a ton.
So you can actually buy these now? I could, if I had $75 million, or wait a second, what if I just wanted one nanotube?
Well, one nanotube you'd blow away with your breath. In fact, you'd blow away an entire pound of the things, but made into cable, they could probably be okay. Mm-hmm. The elevator takes about 100,000 tons, so unless the price had come down, that's $7.5 trillion worth of elevator cable. But my guess is that the stuff will come down to cents per kilogram. There's a neat method that's not been really investigated to speak of called metal solvent, because a lot of molten metals like iron dissolve carbon. And if you can figure out how to get them to precipitate nanotubes, you're in business.
How big would the elevator itself be?
Well, it's rated in capacity. So this is the design that I've been mucking around with. Is one that's designed to deal with 2,000 tons a day. The cable's only about six tenths of a centimeter. So at the bottom, or that's around 3/8 of an inch. And it'd be lifting 6 14-ton loads every hour. The bottom 50 miles of the cable is in parallel with a variable speed cable that runs up to a transfer station at 50 miles. This is all Keith Lostrom's cool idea. And so you hook on a load, accelerate the thing up to, you know, like a couple hundred, 300 miles, 400 miles an hour up through the atmosphere. When you get up to like 40,000 or 50,000 feet, you accelerate all the way up to 1,000 miles an hour. And then as you reach the pulley, you have some grabbers that just reach over the pulley and grab the far cable and let go of the one you're hanging on to. Could get real excited if it fails.
Yeah, that would be something you wouldn't want to see fall over. It's no fun. It fell right over. So you're talking about a lot of money here. And how long would it take the power satellite to pay back the energy that it takes to get itself into orbit?
Well, the cable is dragging enough stuff up to make a 5 gigawatt. It takes about 10,000 tons to build a 5 gigawatt power satellite. So it does. The idea of it is that the cable would bring up the enough materials to build one. So you build it, and that's enough power satellites. You're talking about building like 60 or 70 power satellites in a year's time, and that displaces all the existing coal plants in the U.S. And if you keep doing it, in a few years, you displace all of them in the entire world.
Is there anything you can imagine that might go wrong with the solar panels?
Tons of things go wrong with it. Among them, one of the nasty problems is you've got to clean all the stuff out of lower orbits.
Space junk.
Yeah, you've got to clean up the space junk. So part of the project is 50 or 100 ion tugs that are capable of running around and gathering up all this stuff.
Pac-Man.
Well, you need it. You need it too, because the design of the space elevator needs you either have to have an extraordinarily long cable going out, or you can use a shorter amount of cable and a big solid mass, you know, like either an asteroid or a whole batch of old communication satellites and space stations and all the other kind of junk that's been left up there in orbit.
So, I mean, if I remember correctly, you were talking about, 50 square miles, the size of a medium-sized city, and where might we try locating this thing?
Ah, they all go in geosync. It's a big place. You stick them all in the geosync orbit. And by the way, it's an interesting kind of a thing. These power satellites in geosynchronous have to stay facing the sun with the receptor kind of things, and then the antenna that transmits the power back to the Earth has to rotate around, so it becomes pretty complicated.
What do these things look like from down here?
There's lots of pictures of them on Google. It's easy to look at them, but what would they look like in the sky?
Yeah.
Dots.
Yeah.
Even as something with 10 or 15 kilometers of extent at geosync is only going to look like a dot.
I guess what I was asking is, where do you put the space out? It's going to be on the ground somewhere. It's got to start somewhere. So where on Earth do you put it? Where on Earth do you put it?
Well, you have to put them. There's one other thing I ought to cover on the thing, and that is the energy payback on it.
Okay.
You wind up with a 5 gigawatt power satellite, and it takes roughly a gigawatt of power to drive the motors that drag all this stuff up into orbit. But it takes one day for this thing to repay the energy that it, when it comes online, it's generating 5 gigawatts every day. And so 5 gigawatt days to lift the parts there, it pays back all the energy in a single day. After you account for everything on it, it may well take like a 100 days, you know, all the energy to refine the metals and make the solar cells or whatever else you're using. But the big thing it causes a difference in there is that you get 24-hour sunlight, unfiltered by clouds, and no night, and you can really use much lighter structures for it. You ask where you put this thing, you got to put it on the equator, or really close.
Hmm.
And there's only one place that the U.S. owns that's on the equator. There's a dinky little island. It's called Baker Island, right smack out in the middle of the Pacific. It's 13 miles north of the equator. But if you put a ship anchored 12 miles south of there, it'd still be in U.S. territorial waters. And guess what we use for a ship?
Yeah.
The Enterprise.
Nice.
Well, that belongs to the Navy. So you get the Navy's cooperation? Is that in the plan?
I think so.
They're going to give up a good island that they could put prisoners on?
So the government owns this thing, so we send our energy bills to the government?
It's really hard to say, but the point is to put it under U.S. law, maybe. That's the trick. I don't know whether you want to do that or not, actually, but if you do... Yeah. That's one of the places you can do it. You actually need the Enterprise because you need the initial power to get the thing up there. The Enterprise puts out about 0.2 gigawatt. So you can bootstrap this thing. It takes years to bootstrap it because most of the time all you're doing is lifting more cable. But the Enterprise is due to be decommissioned in 7 years, and you know we got 7 years to put the business plan together.
It's nuclear powered, yeah?
Yes, it is. It's nuclear powered. It's the first... nuclear-powered aircraft carrier.
Now, this gives us some time for carbon nanotubes, perhaps, to come down in price a little bit. I mean, I imagine that once they become used, then the price on those should come down quite a bit.
They're really good stuff for all kinds of different things. They're just absolutely strong. It's just amazing. You can have a quarter-inch or cable there, and you could pick a 150-ton locomotive up with these things.
When can I hold a carbon nanotube in my hand, you know, something made out of carbon nanotubes?
Well, okay. If it was stretched really tight and was a really fine tube, like, say, a thousandth of an inch in diameter, and you ran your hand through the thing, you'd have two pieces.
Two pieces of my hand?
Yep.
So you can't touch these things?
Well, you don't want to touch one that's stretched really tight and is really small.
So it's good for it's good for slicing things up.
So you like? Can you see them? I mean, what?
Think of a cheese wire. You can certainly see them. I mean, you can make the things for this application. You'd wind up with them at least 3/8 inch diameter cable, in order to be able to pick up the kind of loads we need.
Is there stuff being made out of this now, and what are the likely to be some of the first products that will be made from these before we build a space elevator?
There's a fair number of little bits and pieces that are being made out of them. They're used for the scanning probes on scanning tunneling microscopes.
Right.
And they're used nowadays. They're kind of used as a sort of a flock. The very sharp points on the things are used as a way to field emission for flat panel displays and such things.
Now, let's go back to the origins of some of your thinking about this. You've been interested in space for a really long time. In three decades ago, we had the L5 Society. I hear a rumor that there's somebody currently at NASA Ames who, the guy who runs NASA Ames, who is actually sort of into the Gerard O'Neill concept of space colonies. I don't know if you've heard that or not. What do you think has happened with the movement towards space, and do you see some hope in the civilian programs, or what do you think about human beings moving up there?
I don't think it's going to happen.
Ever?
No, not to any serious extent. And the reason is Second Life.
Virtual reality.
The problem is that by the time we have the ability to get into space cheaply, which is going to be the 2030s, late 2030s, early 2040s, we may be well so far into the singularity time that there won't be hardly any population left.
Really? So that's your analysis. Do you think that human beings will have been replaced, or that we'll have a singularitarian disaster of some sort?
I don't know. Even the thing about it is that even something that isn't just a complete disaster could easily wind up with removing people's desire to go into space. There's space was an adventure kind of thing, and
there's the idea of the human need for a frontier. You think that disappears into cyberspace?
It could easily happen. I was amazed by the fact that there was, like, less than a year after it started, there were 300,000 people in Second Life.
Yeah, I actually suspect that this is the Second Life, and that's the Third Life. But and each version of it seems a little worse than the previous one. But
there's always, if you really want one, there's always the simulation argument, which I think you've probably run into.
Sure. All right. So I guess one last question.
I have a question, actually. Oh, yeah. I was wondering, what are the political obstacles to ideas like the space elevator and the power satellite? And what I mean by that is whenever people who are currently in power politically hear these ideas, I imagine they're not very receptive to them, or else we'd hear people talking about them. Do you have any thoughts on why that is, or what kind of prejudices they have that keep them from being agreeable?
Well, good grief, you know. It's even the idea of going up with the powered cables on the thing. you know, at near 100% efficiency instead of 7% efficiency. Just selling that as an idea is extremely difficult because people have become comfortable with that, and they have these climbing competitions, and, you know, building a climber is something you can do in your backyard or, you know, in a reasonable machine shop, whereas, you know, this moving stuff is not.
So people don't think about travel by elevator as much as they think about travel by vehicle. So it would be a hard sell, perhaps, for a politician.
Well, the main thing of it is that people are just very reluctant to accept new ideas. I mean, I've run into this all of my life. Solar power satellites are just one item on the thing. The whole space colony item, you know, was a kind of a flash in the pan because, of course, it ran into the same kind of a problem, namely that of transport getting off the Earth. It's just too expensive.
So one last question. I'm bringing back our creepy friends in Scientology. A religion written by a science fiction writer, I think as a joke or as rumor has it, to just to prove that he could start a religion, but the science fiction nevertheless, and certainly the areas that you've dealt with during your life seem to be sort of science fictional also. So it's almost like a science fiction wars going on here between the authoritarian science fiction religion and the science fictionally influenced folks. It's almost, there seems to be a great novel in there somewhere.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. My own connection with it started clear back when I was in the seventh grade, and my mother read me Farmer in the Sky, and then, you know.
Which is not by Hubbard, it's by...
No, Heinlein.
Heinlein, right.
Hubbard was just... He was at best a third-rate science fiction writer, but he did manage to latch on to a, as they call it, a technology that indeed works. It parts people with their money. By the way, if you ever if you want to find my theory paper on why this occurs, just Google sex, drugs and cults.
All right, well, we will have a link to that and several other things related to all the things Keith Henson has been talking about today on the Are You Serious show. I want to thank Keith Henson for joining us today, and I want to remind you to join us next week when our guest will be a performer who does a show called Gonzo, and he will be here in character as Hunter S. Thompson. Thanks for joining us.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?